Hello, everyone. We would like to welcome you to the Art of Intervention lecture series. Tonight is the second time, the second installment of our lecture series with a talk by Jack Halberstam. We're very, very pleased to welcome Jack to Basel tonight. It's not the first time. We are lucky to have been working with Jack almost a decade ago in gender studies and organized a whole bunch of queer studies workshops with Jack. But by way of introduction, Jack is professor of gender studies and English at Columbia University in the city of New York. Halberstam is a prolific writer, as most of you probably know, and author of 6 books, and I'm not going to name all of them, but notably Female Masculinity, and which has also been translated into different languages, In a Queer Time and Place, The Queer Art of Failure, which is very apt to also, The Art of Intervention lecture series, Gaga Feminism, Sex, Gender, and the End of Normal. And most recently, a short book called Trans, A Quick and Quirky Guide to Gender Variance. Halberstam has co-edited a number of anthologies, including Post-Human Bodies with Ira Livingston, a special issue of Social Text with Jose Munoz and David Eng, entitled What's Queer About Queer Studies Now? And just this July, and I urge you to look at that, is an issue of South Atlantic Quarterly on the theme of wildness with Tavia Nyong'o. Jack gained popularity well beyond academia with projects such as the Brack King book, the blog Bully Bloggers, as well as interventions at places as varied as the Tate Modern, Documenta, international LGBT film festivals, basement pop-up galleries, and obscure queer bars. On themes such as queer failure, sex and media, subcultures, visual culture, gender variance, popular film, animation, and the list goes on. Jack is currently working on several projects, as he always is, and one that I want to mention is a book titled Wild Thing on queer anarchy, performance, and protest culture, the visual representation of anarchy and the intersections of between animality, the human, and the environment. So tonight we're really excited to hear Jack talk about unbuilding gender, trans, and architectures in and beyond the work of Gordon Matta-Clark. And to gender folks, gender studies folks, this probably will be really new and exciting. So without further ado, Jack Halberstam.
Lovely. Thank you, Dominique, for the introduction, and to the museum and Andrea for helping to bring me here. I'm super excited to be here to talk to you in relationship to the show in the museum, especially this Theasta Gates piece on the Madonna and this walking poem. I hope that the work that I discuss by Gordon Matta-Clark will be in conversation with many of the pieces that you can see, either you've already seen in the exhibit or you can come back and see. So I started writing about Gordon Matta-Clark about a year and a half ago. I was given a prize, it's called the Arcus Prize, and it's administered out of Berkeley. And it was really ridiculous that I applied for it because it's about sexuality and the built environment, which, by the way, I don't write about at all. But I thought, oh well, this is a super interesting topic to me. So I applied for the prize and I was given the prize. And then I was like, okay, now I actually have to write something. And one day, it was a snowy day, I went to the Bronx Museum in New York, and they had the work of Gordon Matta-Clark. And the museum was really deserted. There was nobody there. So I spent the whole day there. And by the time I left the museum, I knew that I was going to write about his work in a way that most people don't write about it, namely in relationship to the project of new forms of gendered embodiment. And most people sort of place him in a kind of critical relationship to modernist architecture, say to the work of Le Corbusier or something like that, and he's seen as just sort of the negative version of this masculinist architecture. But there's something very powerful about Gordon Matter-Clark's work, and something very meaningful about it in relationship to debates that we are having now about unmaking the gender binary. So you're going to see me try to wrestle these two discourses so that they begin to speak to each other. One, the discourse of, I'll do these quotes in a moment, the discourse of transgender as it emerges, and two, the project of unbuilding the world that we live in, a kind of anarchistic project that doesn't just seek to remake the world, seeks to destroy the world that we currently live in, and sees that the structures in which we currently live are too oriented towards one version of power and privilege. And so in order to change things, they actually have to come down. Now, the work of Gordon Matter-Clark is perfect for that, as you'll see, because rather than being an architect who builds, he is an architect who unbuilds, okay? He unbuilds buildings, and I'll explain that as we go. This is a great quote from a very quirky architectural theorist whom we all know, Buckminster Fuller, who cannot be accused ever of really making queer statements about architecture. And yet, in this crazy little pamphlet he wrote called I Seem to Be a Verb, he made a statement that is very conversant with contemporary queer theory. He said, I live on Earth at present, and I don't know what I am. I know that I am not a category, I am not a thing, a noun. I seem to be a verb, an evolutionary process, an integral function of the universe. I really like this quote because it reminds us of the grammar that we use, the structural, the linguistic structures that we use to explain ourselves to each other and to explain the world. And Gordon Matter-Clark thinks of architecture as a kind of grammar that has to be disrupted, unmade, and turned around in order for something new to happen. So what if we shift the emphasis, grammatically speaking, from nouns, things, identities, towards verbs, practices, ways of being, doing, okay? That's the sort of intention in this quote. And then, of course, a quote from Gordon Matter-Clark. And this is, he has a massive archive that I went and visited at the Canadian Architecture Museum. And he wrote all kinds of things down on little note cards. And you can sit in that museum for days and just look through the papers and find these note cards. And sometimes it's just this. It'll just say, nothing works. Nothing works is going to be our motto tonight. And that's both a commentary on the world that we live in which nothing works, right? We're in a really weird, grim political moment in which nothing works. But there's another side of this phrase in which he's thinking about the power of nothing, that nothing also does something. And you'll see in the inventive cuts that Gordon Matter-Clark makes into buildings, he makes nothing out of something. Nothing out of something. That's the practice. It's not minimalism, it's not cutting away until you have something very small left. It's cutting away till you have nothing. So tonight I'm interested, and I hope you are too, in nothing. So at the end of this little book that I wrote to try to explain trans issues to non-trans people, I had a little chapter on the Lego movie, which I'm sure you are all cultured people. I'm sure you've seen the Lego movie. The Lego movie is an architectural film in which there are inhabitants of a town called Legoburg. I don't know why it's German, but it is Legoburg. It's not Lego town, it's Legoburg. And the inhabitants of the town are all either builders or architects. And they, therefore, every single day, they remake their world, and at the end of the day, they unbuild the world. And it's this beautiful kind of cycling through different kinds of structures and world-making exercises and so on. And there's an enemy in the film called, I kid you not, Lord Business, who looks a lot like Trump, but it was made before Trump, so that's interesting. And Lord Business decides he has to make his town more governable. So he brings some super glue, and he's going to stick the world into place, because it is not possible to rule a world in which people keep making and unmaking the world every day. So they have to find a particular Lego piece that will stop Lord Business from using the super glue. And they call it the pièce de résistance, okay? And it's a little cap. It's a little cap that you put on the super glue, and it's a little bit phallic, and it's a little bit of a cavity, so it's a trans piece. So I ended my book with this, and I decided, on the basis of the Lego movie, I'm super interested in architecture, as it turns out, and so this is how we end up talking not about architecture, of course, but talking about the opposite. And architecture, the unmaking, unbuilding, and dismantling of the world as we know it. So let's just start with a couple of propositions to move us forward. In transgender studies as well, we used to talk about trans issues in relationship to the metaphor of a journey, that people are on a journey from one gender to another, and they would set out on the journey, and they would go through certain changes, and then they would arrive at the gender destination that they desired. There's been a turn in transgender studies away from thinking about our lives in the body as being like a journey, and more thinking about the life of the body in terms of an architecture, that we live in bodies that we build and unbuild. And everyone does this, actually, not just trans people. Straight people, cisgendered people, regularly change, unmake, and make their bodies all the time. Plastic surgery, you have your eyebrows fixed, you have your teeth altered, you have a gym program that you follow. You make and unmake your bodies, too. But it isn't considered variant or pathological, and therefore it goes unnoticed. Only when people try to remake the body in relationship to gender is it considered to be a problem. So we notice the way that the deviant and the normal line up. So now we want to think then, what would we gain from thinking about making and unmaking the body in architectural terms and move away from the language of the journey? The reason we might want to do so is because actually it's very hard to represent gender ambiguity. It's very, very difficult. If you represent someone who looks a lot like the gender to which they have transitioned, then they just pass. Then you're not representing the ambiguity. And representing ambiguity is very important if we're going to change gender norms significantly. We have to have styles of representation that take us beyond a gender binary. And then finally, in gender studies, we've talked a lot about social construction, the social construction of gender. And this has been one of the main contributions of post-structural feminism, beginning with Judith Butler, that gender is not natural, it is a social construction that then changes the way that any given community thinks about what it means to be in a body. As long as there's been construction then, there's been the possibility that if we can be made, we can be unmade. So I want to move the emphasis away from how we're made and how we're constructed and how we're built and start moving towards the language of unbuilding and unmaking. So that's the sort of the preamble. I hope that we're on the same page now, and we'll move into first, let me talk a little bit about how architecture is gendered. And we'll make that kind of comparison. Then I'll move through the work of Gordon Matta-Clark and then into some of the final projects that he did about space and queer life. So it's not a difficult idea to say that architecture is gendered. And it's also no accident that the big debates in both Europe and the US about transgender bodies have been about bathrooms, right? And this is just an absurd representation of how we should not, as a society, be so completely disoriented by the idea that people of different genders will not fit in two bathrooms, and therefore we should be much more creative about the bathroom. The way we do that is not just by altering the signs. Really, we should rebuild the very concept of the bathroom. And in fact, a transgender theorist, Susan Stryker, is collaborating with an architect, Joel Sanders, and they have a project to completely remake the way in which what we've called the bathroom is situated in public space. So instead of thinking about it in terms of gendered needs, we should think about it in terms of what people do in the bathroom, and reorganize, redesign the space of the bathroom accordingly. Like, do you need to sit down, breastfeed, take a rest, read a book, eliminate? Do you need to meet people, cruise, whatever you may need? We need a different design for the bathroom. So you could say that the bathroom problem that lies at the center of current debates about gender requires an architectural fix, not simply a shift in the languaging, the signs on the bathroom door. So the bathroom problem forces us to think about the way in which all the spaces that we move within are gendered. And just to give you an example that will be really important in the Gordon Matta-Clark section, houses are gendered spaces. No matter how much you design and rethink that space, there's still things like a master bedroom, you know, which the language of a master bedroom is really significant, right? There are some people in the house who are more important than others. They get their own bathroom, the master bedroom. And then the house tends to be set up with the expectation that there will be a family, there will be children, and the space needs to be divided accordingly. But what if we designed houses with a different community in mind, right? Where friends live together. What's a friend house look like? It's interesting. It could be a really, really different setup altogether, where you allow for spaces that are private, other spaces that are public. What if spaces were connected? What if we designed neighborhoods, and there are such projects, both historically and in contemporary life, where people are encouraged, in fact, to think about sharing resources, space, time together, so that a neighborhood was set up so that the whole neighborhood took care of kids, not just the family with the baby monitor. Homes are set up to be surveillance systems, basically, and they are divided according to masculine functions, feminine functions, heteronormative functions, and the sustaining of the concept of the domestic. We need to rethink the domestic, unbuild the house in order to think about it differently in relationship to different forms of community. All kinds of people have thought about gendered space going way back into the 1940s. Louise Bourgeois, who of course very famously made these little house-like structures within her spiders. Many of her spider sculptures had little homes built within them. But she also did this amazing series called Femme Maison, in which the female body is represented as a kind of housing, right? So there's your most obvious and iconic mode of gendered architecture, is seeing the female body as a house. It is a house out of which other bodies come, right? And for her, the house was a trap. It was a trap that she felt she was built into. The meaning of femininity was completely combined with the meaning of housing, and it was something that she pushed against and tries to paint her way out of. Which, of course, is a reminder, therefore, that where there's a house that is represented as feminine, there is an architect represented as masculine. And the perfect example of that is Ayn Rand's Howard Roark from The Fountainhead. And, you know, never has Ayn Rand been more in style than in this age of neoliberal accumulation, in which the newly wealthy want to believe that they are wealthy because they are special, which is the very narrative that Ayn Rand tried to sell back in the 1960s. And still, The Fountainhead is a go-to book among right-wing groups, and it's a sort of understood as the opposite of a kind of socialist ethos. No accident, therefore, that the right wing thinks about its special people as architects, literally people who make the world and make it according to their needs and in relationship to their concepts of mastery. So it's within that context then that we want to think about a really quirky, cool group of people who in the anarchistic, crumbling streets of New York of the 1970s, and if anyone ever, you're too young probably, but New York in the 1970s was already a city falling down. And Gordon Matta-Clark in his journals writes about the fact that one of the meaningful moments of his childhood is when a building on his street collapsed and a child was killed in the rubble. And he remembers this collapse of the housing as a kind of significant representation of the city within which he lived. 1970 to 1977, a group emerged in New York City that counted among its members Laurie Anderson and Richard Landry, but also Gordon Matta-Clark, who was its main member and was the person who mostly participated in what we're going to call an architectural practices. Matta-Clark is a super cool guy. He was a Chilean refugee. Came to New York City. His father, Roberto Mata, was a very famous painter who studied with Le Corbusier for a while, and then the father decided he hated everything that Le Corbusier stood for and passed this on to his son, who went to Cornell to graduate school to learn architecture. And everything that he learned at Cornell, he brought home and decided to completely disobey, okay? He took it all. He understood exactly how to make things, how to build. He read Corbusier. He read all of the major architectural theories, and he used it to try to take apart the discipline in which he had been trained. A really good project for any grad students in the audience. I do recommend that. There's no reason to simply take knowledge as it has already been created and then embody it. The point is to take it, destroy it, remake it, and do something completely different. So if you think of someone like Le Corbusier, and if you've ever been to any of his homes that he built, the idea of the architect of the building was that it should be a machine to live in, made of the utmost efficiency. Everything has to be exactly where it is supposed to be for an efficient world to function. He also likened modern architecture to the image of nature. So you can see the normativity that creeps into mainstream architectural theory. Frank Lloyd Wright, same thing, believed that architecture was another version of nature. It was just a building in the natural world. And it's that version of architecture that Gordon Matta-Clark comes to destroy. He was in complete disagreement with Le Corbusier, who wrote, "Everything must hold together or it will collapse. Everything must hold together or it will collapse." By contrast, Gordon Matta-Clark suggested that all of his unbuilding was oriented towards collapse, right? Everything must hold together or it will collapse. What's really strong in that sentence is not that things hold together. What's the emphasis in the sentence is that if you don't hold things together, they will collapse. And Matta-Clark takes this as a kind of foregone conclusion that things will collapse if not held together, and starts to remove the supports that hold everything together, orienting towards collapse. And he said that his goal was to create buildings that were just barely standing and therefore were in the very sort of moment somewhere between being upright and collapsing, okay? Finding that moment is everything. And I'll give you some examples of that as we go. He did not think about his work as a kind of art piece. It was not painting. It was not painting by other means, by architectural means. It was architecture with a new grammar. So here is the statement that makes this very clear, and this is in an interview with Liza Baer, who was one of his most assiduous interlocutors. He said, "It's not a canvas, no. I'm dealing with architectural structure as reality." Okay, so we can't get away with just thinking this is just performance. Architectural structure as reality. I mean, there's something about the house which is very substantial, especially in terms of the environment in which it exists. It's like juggling with syntax or disintegrating some kind of established sequence in parts. I mean, I think this is a really beautiful statement that gets to the practice that he engages. What if there is a syntax to architecture? What if you mess with it? And you don't mess with it just to make it more beautiful or more monumental, think Richard Meier or someone like this. You mess with it to bring it to its knees. What, that's also an architectural project, by the way. It is not easy to bring a house down. It's actually very difficult to make a house fall. And there are all kinds of cuts that you have to make, and only certain cuts, not others. Okay? So what we're doing here is taking the actual grammar of architecture, and it's like William Burroughs or somebody, cutting it up and then re-sorting its pieces to create something really different. And we'll look and see what that looks like in a moment. I think if you want to think about, well, why would you turn to this project now? We're living at the other end of a real estate boom that began when Gordon Matta-Clark began his work. You can kind of trace the movement of market forces into real estate back to the 1970s. And we're living now with the consequences of a market built on real estate, right? Because what is the image of a capital surplus in this day and age? Houses, right? In every major city, there are luxury buildings going up that nobody lives in. So in New York City, San Francisco, Vancouver, Hong Kong, in these places, we talk about the fact that there are homeless problems. Why are there homeless problems? Because people can no longer afford basic housing because of the gentrification that is the other end of the luxury housing market. So I'd like to propose, in relationship to anarchitecture, that we don't have homeless problems. We have home full problems. Like, if you take the logic he's asking for here, the problem is not that some people don't have houses. The problem is the other end of the market where capital must find somewhere to live, literally, and so it goes into luxury apartment buildings that stand empty. Now, that was true in the 70s, but in the 1970s, people squatted. People saw empty buildings, they moved in, squatters' rights kick in after a certain amount of time, and you live there. And in some places in Spain and in Greece, there are still squatters' rights. Most places, security is such that you never will make it into an empty building. So I know in New York City that there are massive luxury buildings going up every day that are not really even for sale. They are investment properties, places to put money. That's why people have returned now to anarchitecture, because of the sense that we have to unbuild the world where the money is so oriented towards a real estate paradigm. And this begins at the very beginning of Matta-Clark's career, and I'll give you the piece that I think really makes this statement in a second. Okay, so before we get there, however, I just want to make a few arguments about gender studies making this architectural turn. So if you agree with me that architecture is gendered, we have a paradigm within which unbuilding the world makes a certain amount of sense, where our market is invested in real estate. Now we want to know how gender studies and theory has come to be invested in architecture. And one of the really, really great early works that brought together gender theory and architecture was by Paul Preciado. It's not the book that he became famous for, Testo Junkie. It's the thing he wrote as a dissertation at Princeton with Beatrice Colomino, who also writes about the Playboy mansion. So in Pornotopia, Preciado makes the argument that in the post-war world of the 1960s and 70s, masculinity was remade. And it was remade in an architectural style that took as its iconic image the Playboy Mansion of Hugh Hefner. And he does a whole study of the way that the principle of the Playboy takes hold of masculinity and turns it into a new form of patriarchy. Okay? And this isn't his argument, but it's an argument that I'm willing to make, where patriarchy takes the form of a kind of architectural project, then again, patriarchy has to be unbuilt. And since Hugh Hefner just died recently, this is a good moment to start thinking about how to take apart patriarchy. We're also in the middle of this Me Too moment where it seems like people are interested in a critique of patriarchy. But it'll only work, we can only dismantle patriarchy if we move away from sort of individual narratives towards a much more structural understanding of both the problem and potentially the solution. The solution to the question of what it would mean to unbuild patriarchy already appears in feminist texts in the 1980s. So the conversation we're now having about patriarchy is long overdue. People had this conversation in the 70s and 80s. Let me give you an example. An example, by the way, that uses an architectural metaphors. Audre Lorde is probably best known for a sort of motto, an epigraphic type of statement that people use a lot but don't think about. She said in an essay in 1984, "The master's tools will never dismantle the master's house." She says, "For the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. They may allow us temporarily to beat him at his own game, but they will never enable us to bring about genuine change. And this fact is only threatening to those women who still define the master's house as their only means of support." And she was really speaking here to other feminists, to white feminists who she thought, you know, were invested in feminism but weren't really invested in bringing down patriarchy. But the important piece here, I believe, is that first statement, "The master's tools will never dismantle the master's house." And people have returned to this statement mostly to think about the tools. The master's tools will not dismantle the master's house. But it's the other part of the statement that's so important. Dismantling the house is where the emphasis actually falls. It doesn't really matter what tools you use in the end. What Audre Lorde is saying, what we're here to do is dismantle the master's house. Remember that master bedroom? It's coming down, right? So I think this is really a return. Gordon Matt Clark was working in the 70s. This was in the 80s. We're returning to a sort of anarchist project from the 70s and 80s that never came to pass, but whose time has come. And you can never go wrong with Grace Jones, who in the 1980s wrote a song called Demolition Man, in which she also called for the demolition and destruction of everything. I'm not going to go over this in any kind of great detail. I only put this slide up to show that even the arc of Judith Butler's work moves from gender trouble in 1989 to, by the early 2000s, undoing gender. Again, the dismantling, the unmaking, the unbuilding. And so you can see that that logic sort of carries through post-structuralist gender studies. All right, so that's the relationship of an architecture to gender studies, the history, the very early history of an architecture, and the history of a gender critique, all of which is oriented towards bringing down the house, dismantling the patriarchal system, and thinking about how to unbuild a world that is so dependent upon real estate transactions. Okay, let's actually look at some work then in this next section by Gordon Matta Clark, see what it is he does, and see if we can understand what the project might be. So I want to start with a work of his called Splitting, that was from 1974. In this project, he didn't destroy a house so much as he literally split it down the middle. Where did he get the house? He bought a house at 322 Humphrey Street in a suburb of New Jersey. And this was one of the first waves of real estate collapse. Housing in the post-war era boomed, and there was a sort of promise in the post-war years that everyone could have a home in the suburb. Everyone meant white people, and that was the moment of white flight. White people left American cities, went into the suburbs, owned a home. The next wave was the bust side of that economy, and housing payments began to go unpaid, and we ended up with a massive number of foreclosures by the mid-1970s. Matterclock got this house for nothing because it was foreclosed upon. It was on land owned by his art dealers, Holly and Horace Solomon, and was slated already for demolition. So here's a house on land. The house is worth nothing. The land is worth a lot. The house is worth nothing. So this is like the beginning of that boom-bust cycle that we're talking about. So he decides he's going to split the house open. And that's what it ends up looking like. All of his projects he photographed and filmed. And actually watching the films, they're very moving films. They really are. It's really amazing to see the transformation of the structure from coherence to incoherence and see the kinds of cuts that need to be made. This was considered a very controversial project, and one feminist theorist accused Gordon Matterclock of raping the building. She claimed he brings a big chainsaw in and he cuts through the building, and she suggests, confirming the logic that the house is a woman and the architect is a man, she says that the chainsawing of the house is a kind of rape, which he completely refuses. But interestingly enough, after this project, he declined to work on domestic spaces anymore. He was, you know, taken enough with the critique that he didn't do this kind of work again. Nonetheless, I think that you want to see this work as something that is trying to dismantle the idea that the house is the woman and the architect is the man, because he's abnegating from the role of the architect by refusing to build and instead engaging in the unbuilding. And I think this image from the inside is really beautiful, because what I want to call your attention to is not simply that the house is now divided in two, which is a sort of still where it's still in a binary structure. The thing that you're really looking at, and you can see this much more clearly from the inside, is that nothing works. Remember the statement, nothing works? We're actually looking at nothing. We're looking at the split itself. It's the split, the vacuum, the sliver of air that is the art piece. That is what he's actually created. So on the one hand, the house is split, and that itself is a major endeavor, because if you split a house open very often, it will collapse. So even though he did take a chainsaw, he also tilted the entire house back on its axis. And it's the tilt that allowed the house to fall open. And in doing so, it's a kind of ideological exposé. It's like saying, look inside. But then it's also about seeing the split in the house that is always already there, and that marks a kind of crisis in the housing itself. A space of nothing, a space of possibility, if you like. And the theorist Karen Barad, for example, talks about the vacuum. She reminds us that a vacuum is not a space of nothing. It's a space in which matter behaves in a very particular way. Behaves in a negative way, but it is acting anyway. Similarly, an architecture creates these spaces of nothing against which something can be seen. The same year that he engaged in this act of splitting the house, there was a very significant gender theory book came out by Robert Stoller called Splitting, A Case of Female Masculinity, which not many people read this book, but it's a fascinating case, and it is very, very similar in form to the Gordon Matterclock project. It's a case of a woman, Mrs. G., a patient diagnosed with sociopathic and violent tendencies. She literally was diagnosed with schizophrenia because she believed she had a penis. She believed she had it, you know, and the doctor's like, you don't? And she's like, I do. And for 10 years, they argued about it. This is what the book is about. But more than that, he calls her sociopathic because she wants to kill people. men specifically. She literally wants to dismantle patriarchy, and for that she is institutionalized. His diagnosis of Mrs. G is splitting, that she is so split apart by her belief that she has a penis that she is unable to function in reality. She says back to him, "No, that's not the case. I just live in a different reality than the one that you live in." And she is literally a kind of what Preciado would call a contrasexual subject. She believes that her body is prosthetic, that it is extended in all kinds of ways. And if you go and look at the Hito Steele exhibit upstairs, all of the work on robots is about the prosthetic extension of embodiment. She also believes that her body is the site for prosthetic extension. And she, through the course of the book, from the space of the patient, articulates a theory of gender that is very conversant with what we now call post-structuralist gender theory. So he, just to go over this, to make the connection here, he characterizes her as a walking bomb. He says she's dangerous because she's capable of splitting off her understandings of the world from socially normative narratives. This, in fact, is her strength. She sees that in the world she lives in, the penis stands for social power, and so she imagines a penis for herself. For her, it isn't about the physical organ. It is that she herself understands herself to be masculine in a way that is powerful. She is the perfect trans and architectural subject, a contrasexual who understands that power is prosthetic and can be extended from the body. So this is, the diagnosis is one of splitting. And I think we can read now the house as also a version of this same phenomenon in which the space of heteronormativity is literally split in such a way that it cannot be put back together again. It is unmade, destroyed, and in the process exposed. So if you read those two texts together, two texts that fortunately actually have the same name, you can see that in both of them, there's a kind of critique of the normative world within which they appear. All right. So to move towards a conclusion then, I want to turn to some of Gordon Matlock's later work that is deeply engaged with a site that was understood already to be gay. So the connection between Gordon Matlock, who is a straight man with a wife and kids, and queerness is very, it's not about his identity. It's about the aesthetic practices he engaged and the ways in which he understood the city. So I'm going to think about a work that he did called Day's End. In the 1970s in New York City, the New York piers were falling down. They were a former site of industry, of an earlier moment of capital, where big ships used to come into the New York harbor, they used to dock, and all of the things that needed to come to New York City came in through the piers. By the 1970s, the shipping industry had failed. The West Side Highway had collapsed because there was no money. New York was completely bankrupt by that time. The West Side Highway collapsed, and as a consequence, the piers were abandoned. As it turned out, the piers became a temporary home to squatters, drug addicts, homeless people, and gay men. Gay men, and here you can see the kind of cruising ground that it represented. Gay men came to the piers to cruise outside of the bars because the bars were often raided by police, and they were way less safe than these falling down structures that they turned into their own. And many, many artists congregated here. African-American artist Alvin Baltrop made a whole series of portraits of the men who came and cruised in the piers. In his lifetime, he was not well known at all. It was only towards the end of his life, Douglas Crimp found some of his work and sort of had some shows around his work. And at that time, it was discovered that he had taken some of the only photographs of some of the most important photographs of a work that Gordon Matlock did on the piers called Day's End, which I'll show you. And some of the photographs by Baltrop of the Day's End piece are stunning. These are some of Baltrop's photographs of cruising. And of course, if anyone was in New York recently, you will have seen the Wojnarowicz show at the Whitney. Many of David Wojnarowicz's early paintings were in the piers. And of course, they were destroyed along with the piers. When the piers fell down, the paintings were lost. But some of these gorgeous sort of Picasso quoting pieces were drawn in Pier 34. So you can see, you know, that the fact that the piers are collapsing makes them new ground for all kinds of illegal, informal practices that will never end up in a museum, that are outside of the informal economy of the bar system, and that create a kind of community of the dispossessed, is what you would find in the piers in the 1970s. And it is to the piers that Gordon Matta-Clark went for one of his most well-known pieces called Day's End. And it was Pier 52 in 1975. And by the way, Gordon Matta-Clark died at the age of 36. He died a few years later. So the work that we're talking about is carried out over a very short period of time and coincides with this, you know, emergence of gay community in New York. So the piers, he had a different idea about the piers in many ways than the gay men did. For the gay men, this was a site that could be turned into fertile cruising ground, free from the police and free from the scrutiny of normal people. For Matta-Clark, he had another idea. His question in Day's End was, why can't we have amazing architecture in public spaces? Why is architecture something you pay for? Why isn't architecture for the public good? So he decided to cut into the walls and the floors of the piers in very specific places to bring light and water into the piers and open them up. And his hope was people would come there for sort of recreational purposes. Not that you would have now a park and a dog park and, you know, it wasn't like a fountain. It was more to create something that people would want to come see in the piers that would create a sense of community out of the ashes of something that was collapsing. And because it was collapsing, it was made all the more sort of interesting architecturally. The gay men did not like Gordon Matta-Clark being there. Douglas Crimp is super critical of him. When he was making these cuts, he would put a lock on the pier, and the gay men thought that this was a sign of kind of possession, that he owned Pier 52, when in fact he was worried that people would walk in and fall into the filthy Hudson. And so he put the lock on for when he wasn't there to make sure that people didn't wander in and end up going through the floor. But he, anyway, was seen as somebody who was hostile to the gay men, even though he was often hanging from the rafters in a harness, making these cuts, alongside Alvin Baltrop, who was taking photographs. And the gay men were all walking below them. They were all there at the same time. And I think, regardless of anyone's intention, it's kind of a fantastic image to think of this huge, random community of dispossessed people for whom the places in New York that have been abandoned become a completely different kind of playground. So, and Baltrop, what I love about Baltrop's photographs is that they don't sort of fetishistically simply focus in on the sex acts themselves. He's really interested, in fact, in the relationship between the bodies and the architecture. And there's a lot of his photographs are really about the architecture of the piers and the architecture of cruising, how important the ambiance is. The kind of ruination of the piers creates an incredible ground for cruising. And here's one of the photographs that he does, one of the very few photographs from outside of the pier that captures these incredible cuts. And again, the cut is very difficult because these piers are in danger of collapsing at any moment. And he is literally hanging from the ceiling and making these semicircular cuts. But I think you can see that an architecture has its own kind of aesthetic. Again, nothing works. The nothing that is the cut is something extraordinary, right? It's giving you access and giving you a kind of loop peephole into a completely different world. Nowadays, those this is an interesting time to think about exactly that time, precisely because all sense of cruising has gone the way of everything else. It's gone online, and this is the Grindr logo, of course, and something that was seen as wildly counter-capitalist in the 1970s, as something outside of the logic of accumulation that the bars represented, is now basically one of the main hubs for, profiting from the desire of gay men. And gay men are seen as an enormously profitable group by apps like Grindr, who know that they have a completely, willing audience for all the things that they want to sell you. And at the same time, you turn all your information over, you tell them all about your health status and all kinds of other things, make intimate portraits of your body and post them up online. So it's a collection agency for information. So that earlier moment is actually something really special to think about in the era of digital capital in that form. Okay, I want to conclude then to go back to where I began, thinking about trans and architecture. And I just have three examples for you of artists who are trans-identified and who I believe are engaged in an architectural performances. And then I'll make a very, very short concluding statement. So I'll just do these quickly. Some people may know Castle's work. Castles is a genderqueer artist. They have been training their female body to look as if it has a kind of masculine musculature since they were 15, so they are not on hormones, they have not had surgeries, but they have built that body, literally built it in the gym, and created a piece called Becoming an Image, in which, in a dark room lit only by flash photography, they destroyed a block of clay with their body, which was also destroyed in the process. So that dynamic in which a block of clay is destroyed and unmade, and the body is also unmade, they carry out the performance until collapse in a sort of Marina Abramovich way. Once they collapse, the performance is over. That's a kind of trans an architecture, or it's a gesture, if you like, an architectural statement. Second artist is Laris Cohen, who began life as a ballet dancer, transitioned, and here you can see more of a surgically made body, continued to dance, and then decided to not focus so much on dance, but to focus on the architectural space in which people dance. And one of his early pieces was to take apart the sprung floor. So when people do dance, they need a very particular kind of floor that is sprung. It has some bounce in it. And they took that floor apart and labeled it as a transsexual floor because it has flexibility within it and it's able to move. This is another piece of theirs called Waltz. And you'll notice the wall sign says white wall, white floor, white wall, white floor, black wall, black floor, white transsexual. So there's a kind of, and there's a kind of unmaking of the site where the piece should be hung. Again, the attention is to the architectural site, not simply to the piece, which is being unmade and unwritten with these large tearing marks. But also the transsexual is one of the materials with which the piece is made. And then that's him taking apart the sprung floor. He also, by the way, rebuilt one of Martha Graham's early sets. He rebuilt it from scratch and introduced a few differences that were trans architecture. And then for his Whitney Biennial piece, he took a piece of the old Whitney Museum, wrote transsexual on it, and moved it across town to the new Whitney. So he literally, in that way that Gordon Matta-Clark took pieces out, he took a piece out of the old museum and placed it in the new. So there's that kind of prosthetic extension. You have an old museum and a new museum. You have a piece of the body that carries over from one museum to the next. There's an understanding of the museum space itself as bodily. And then finally, an artist about whom I write a lot. This is a genderqueer artist called Boychild, who engages in an architectural performances, often with a Thai artist called Korakrit, in which Korakrit creates huge installations of apocalypse, and Boy Child performs these dances that are part of, they are supposed to conjure a world coming undone. Okay, so I want to just then return in closing to that Audre Lorde quote. For the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. They may allow us temporarily to beat him at his own game, but they will never enable us to bring about genuine change. So in the spirit of removing the master's house altogether, Anna architecture offers acts of unbuilding and dismantling that rhyme with, for instance, contemporary efforts to remove racist monuments. And whether it's in South Africa or in the American South, you know what I mean, the move to destroy the icons, as in this case, of the American South, who continue in the U.S. to represent Americanness. And there's this great Theaster Gates piece over here that I think is mimicking this activity of toppling the iconic reminders of a past that in the national memory is still glorious, but for us has to be completely and utterly destroyed, like taking down a Cecil Rhodes statue violently in South Africa, for example. Such achievements remind us that we should and we must abandon the master's tools, but more fundamentally, and by any means necessary, the master's house, all of its monuments and buildings that it authors and authorizes, and all of those dependent upon it, must fall. We're in a new and architectural moment, I would argue, and everything must come down. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack, so much for this wonderful, wonderful talk and basically a call to not just sit here and be quiet, but to, undo the house. So,
Not tonight.
Or maybe afterwards when there is a, nice reception with wine and cheese. But before that, we're having probably like around half an hour of time to, talk, to speak and ask maybe also questions about, what Jack was talking about. So the floor is open, ask away.
There's a concept in modern physics called the energy of the vacuum.
Energy of what?
Does this find its correspondence in your thinking about nothingness?
What was the concept? Energy?
The vacuum energy.
Vacuum.
Vacuum energy.
Yeah. No, exactly. I mentioned Karen Barad's work, and Karen has a... Karen is trained as a theoretical physicist, but she writes about gender and many other things. And she, I mentioned that she tries to reorient the way that we think about the vacuum. We think a vacuum is the absence of matter. But in fact, in order for a vacuum to be a vacuum, there is intense energy. And she describes it as a place where wild nothingness happens. And I think it's a very good connection to what I'm trying to draw attention to in Gordon Matter Clark. It's not just taking a house down, although the one place that he did take down was this one. This is one of his, one of the pieces that is best known because it's so beautiful what he did. This is called Conical Intersect. And when the Centre Pompidou was being built, they had to take down all kinds of buildings in the vicinity, including a 17th century building. So he got permission to go and cut basically a cone into the very center of the building. He literally hollowed it out and created something like a vacuum through this neighborhood that was being dismantled to call attention to the aesthetics of nothing, the aesthetic, and to also maybe make a marker to remind people of what was there and what would have to be removed in order for something else to come in, which we constantly are like, oh, wasn't there something here, you know, and then suddenly there's a new building and there's no marker of what was gone. So he tries to create these gorgeous internal spiraling structures to call attention to the life of the house, even when it's fallen into disrepair and there's nothing in there. So yes, this is a perfect analogy.
Yeah, there's a question over there.
I have a question about the piece about the in the pier.
Yeah.
And more particularly, how you might disagree with Douglas Crimp on this, because the way that you describe it could be seen still as a kind of violent occupation of a very sensitive space. And so I wonder how you differ in that interpretation.
Yeah, I really disagree with Douglas Crimp, actually. You know, Crimp is somebody who really romanticizes the piers. A lot of gay male critics romanticized the piers and saw them as this kind of the golden age of gay hustling, in a way, because it was unregulated and huge numbers of men went there. And it was the pre-AIDS era as well. So it was it seemed to be sort of cruising without consequence in these incredible spaces. And it was also very meaningful in terms of the way that people were creating community. And so Crimp is one of the great narrators of that time, of that period, and of that community. But the thing is, you know, and this is a weird quibbling in a way, but I would almost say that Gordon Matta-Clark had a more expansive understanding of what the piers could be, because as long as it's only for gay men, it's actually a male-only space. And if anyone's read Samuel Delaney's Times Square Red, Times Square Blue, in which he laments the end of cruising in Times Square after gentrification, he talks about what Times Square was before gentrification and describes it as a kind of sexual ecology of subterranean gay lives. And one day when he's cruising, he takes a female friend with him to the cruising scene, and she's just like, no, thank you. No, this is not my utopia. This feels weird and scary, and we're in a slimy sex theater, and it's filthy, and, you know, it's not her utopia at all. So one of the things that I think Crimp doesn't understand is, and to be fair, Gordon Matta-Clark did make a homophobic comment about the gay men there at one point. He was just like, you know, it seems to be completely overrun by these gays, right? But he then came back around a few years later and made different kind of comments about cohabiting with the gay men who were already there. But what I'm pushing is, notice, not just for some queer utopia. I'm seeing a different kind of configuration of dispossession that Matta-Clark is reaching for, that isn't just like, oh, gay people are going to be the vanguard of something. It's recognizing that there are forms of capital that create new communities out of dispossession, who, because of the way in which ideology works, don't understand themselves together as part of the same struggle. And I think Gordon Matta-Clark's vision is that larger vision. Does that make sense?
Hello, thank you for your talk. I have a question about intentionality or the planning of the outcome. And the reason why I'm asking this question is because I was thinking of a performance that a friend of mine made a few years back, an artist but trained architect, Paul Polaris, and she said, Zurich needs a ruin. And she actually worked with a pyrotechnician, I don't know if that's the word, and she planned it out and handed it into the city of Zurich. Obviously, she wasn't allowed. She wanted to tear down the art museum in Zurich. And she documented that. She did it in technically precisely, right? But she didn't have a precise idea of how it should be at the end. So I'm wondering, how do you relate to ruins and nothingness and cutting out?
Yeah, notice that there are two different projects here. Like, one is where you pull down the thing, the monument, you know, which is where I end. Whereas Matta-Clark is cutting into things that are already ruins. Yeah, and he's both calling attention to the ruination that is required in order for shiny new things to be built. Something else is going to fall apart. So the intentionality is, there's a lot of intentionality in Matt Clark's work. For example, in the splitting, you know, at first when I was reading about it, I was like, oh, he's going to split this house down the middle. You see him with the chainsaw and you're like, oh, wow, he's just going to cut down the middle of the house. That's so cool. You can't do that. If you cut down the middle of the house and you cut into a load-supporting beam, the whole thing comes down. So it's actually planned very, very carefully. And he's using this sawzall to cut, and then he's using other things to tilt. It's the cutting and the tilting that are happening at the same time. And I think there's a guy called Eric Aliez who has written a blow-by-blow account, architecturally speaking, of what Matt Clark did to split that house. And there's more goes into splitting a house, it turns out, than building the damn thing, especially because it wasn't a very nice house. So it wasn't like someone had put incredible amounts of architectural intention into making that little clapboard house. But to split it to the point of collapse without collapse, that's a physics problem as much as it's an architectural problem. And that's where his intention is. The intention, I think, with the piers is to bring in light, which, going back to your point, could be a deeply problematic kind of venture. Why does it have to be light? The gay men don't want it to be light. They actually want it to be dark in many cases. So this idea of bringing light, the enlightenment, is it's a questionable gesture in that space. But then again, people who were there agreed that the particular cuts that he made have this incredible kind of glorious effect because of the water beneath and the light above. And it has been described as a kind of cathedral-like atmosphere that people, you know, were just like, it was wonderful. It was an incredible space. It was transformed, I think is the point. Samuel Delaney, again, who's one of the best chroniclers of New York City at this time, called his own memoir, The Motion of Light on Water. And it's hard not to think of that piece when reading that title, you know. So I know that's not exactly your question, but the intentionality with Matt Clark is twofold. Critique of architecture, on the one hand, and on the other hand, to create something really different from the process of unbuilding.
Thank you very much for your talk. I have a question, or I would like to have your opinion on the fact that I think that what is really queer in Matt Clark's work as well is the, how do you say that in English, ephemeral, temporary art. It's, you do a lot of research, it's a lot of work, and then it's kind of almost for nothing. And I think that for me that's really queer, and I would like to have your opinion about that.
You're saying it's ephemeral, it's like there's nothing that remains. Exactly, and so for an art market, it's, you know, it refuses the production of work only to create new forms of currency. So there isn't, you know, there wasn't much left. What you see in the museum when you go to a Gordon Matt Clark show, as I did at the Bronx, you see films and then sometimes recreations of things and then some of his graffiti slabs and photographs of things that he did in the Bronx. Like, just to give an example, and that's why the show was in the Bronx Museum. He was invited by one of his professors from Cornell to come and do a show in the Bronx with the professor. And he got there early and he shot all the windows out in the building where they were going to have the show. And that was his piece. And the professor was so angry. I know his name, I can't think of it. I think it's Peter Eisenman, there. He was so angry that this, you know, actually impaired Matt Clark's ability to even move in the art world for a while after that. But, you know, we're still talking about Chris Burden, his shot, you know, being shot in the arm. What Matt Clark was again trying to say was that this is the Bronx, people. Buildings are abandoned, windows are blown out. There's gunshots all the time on the street. He's trying to call attention to the way in which wealthy parts of the city depend upon the ransacking of the poor parts of the city. He was constantly interested in that dynamic. And I really am trying to make a lot of the fact that he bought this house for nothing in the splitting house, in one of these dips that have become completely characteristic of the real estate market. There's a kind of prediction there about the way in which real estate will function, even though in the 70s, that's not exactly how it functioned then.
If there's no question at the moment, I actually have a question. Sort of to bring it back a little bit around or to the questions of gender and unbuilding gender. And you went through these last three artists quite quickly. And to just to ask you to expand a little bit about the trans moment where you see a potential of unbuilding gender in these specific examples.
Yeah, thanks Dominique. That's a great question. So I didn't want to suggest that Gordon Matlock is just like one of a kind. I mean, that really just sort of contributes then to the great man theory of art. Instead, I wanted to place some of the artists in whom I'm interested in a direct sort of lineage and conversation with Matlock. So really the person I'm sort of most interested in right now is Yves Laris-Cohen, who just had his first solo show in San Diego. And again, he makes pieces that are not really art market pieces. He's a dancer, and a lot of his work is about the materials of dance, the built environment within which dance takes place. And as I said, he has this sort of affinity with Martha Graham, who also has a kind of, there's some interesting and architectural elements to her work. You know, one of the grammars of Martha Graham's work is withdrawal and withholding and the sort of the not taking certain steps. And so he's in a dialogue with that, but he's also constantly removing things, like these slabs that he, and then the pushing the slab around town, which seems so nonsensical. Unless you see these two buildings as sort of architectural bodies within which a piece is being transferred from one body to the other, and then there's a sort of interesting transing and extension that occurs. Castles is obviously an architectural in the way in which they make their body and unmake it, and they also have a photo project in which they photograph their body every day in the tradition of Mary Kelly and Eleanor Anton and others, photograph their body every day over the course of something like 2 months when they were getting ready for an athletic event. And the changes to the body are extraordinary as they almost waste away in order to get to maximum fitness. So this is sort of literally like unmaking the body in that process. Yeah. No takers on anarchy, I see. So we're all anarchists today, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there. Begin. Not directly related to the anarchy, but just more a question or an invitation to talk a little bit more about what unbuilding. I'm very intrigued by that, and I do relate that to the anarchy aspect as well. Insofar that, so unbuilding is not unmaking, it's not undoing, right? It's unbuilding.
Right.
It's not destroying, right?
Right.
This
right.
is, you know, seems to be very critical. And it already, seems that it also entails like an emancipatory undoing, right? That's how I read it. And but when I looked at the examples that you showed, just, you know, to understand this a little better, it seems that Gordon Water-Clark, whom I'm not familiar with his work, you know, made out of spaces that were deemed to be dysfunctional or not very valuable to be hospitable again, right, in different ways. And that seems to be maybe not so radical than really destroying the house,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. Look, I mean, that's why I spent quite a bit of time at the beginning on the way in which this is a kind of grammatical intervention. I mean, he understands architecture. Think of architecture almost as a dance. It's a choreography. There are certain moves that have to be made. There's certain support and foundations that have to be laid. And then there are, within that, there are certain variations and provisional moves. So his point was that he didn't see the building as a canvas. He didn't see it as another kind of art. He understood that the reality we live in is architectural. And part of its impact is that you don't always understand that you're being held in space by certain forces that are architectural. Precisely because they're architectural, they're made to sort of disappear. So that whether it's, you know, until trans people suddenly say, but where are we going to the bathroom, right? The bathroom's just a bathroom. It's not any kind of space. It's just, in fact, a banal space that shouldn't even be discussed, right? Whereas, in fact, it is organizing the entire logic of male, female, as if there is nothing that exceeds those categories and nothing else is needed. So I think that this, you know, yeah, just cutting into a building or taking a piece out, those in and of themselves are not the pulling down. It's the ideological import, right, of a kind of shuffling. He calls it a shuffling of syntax.
Sorry,
yeah, go ahead.
I wasn't clear enough, maybe. The master, because you were giving also the master's tools quote, right? I mean, the master also likes to destroy and rebuild, right? I mean,
sure.
Naomi Klein's disaster capitalism is all about,
right,
you know, it's embedded within that,
right.
In that demarcation line. That was where my question was coming from.
Yes, of course. There is no tactic that we will ever come up with that is not also a tactic of, you know, capital or autocracy or whatever. There aren't pure gestures. So there are only better, more creative or more inventive or more impactful gestures that we have to think through from the particular political positions that we inhabit. Looking for a place of political purity is definitely not the point to say only we destroy, they don't destroy. I mean, Trump makes and unmakes the world every day as well, you know, on Twitter, and no less. So destruction can be very easy, very infantile. It's also, as again, the Martha Rosler and the Hito Steil exhibits show us, the militarization of destruction and then the way in which those systems infiltrate the everyday. Absolutely. The emphasis shouldn't be on a kind of fetishistic notion of destruction. It's more that if we want to change things, like I gave the example of, say, Me Too, it won't be changed by just like 5, 15, 1,500, 15,000 women saying this thing happened to me. Yeah, it's actually not a big surprise. What will change only is if we take apart the structure within which that is unremarkable, number one, and number two, people can do those forms of sexual assault and live to tell the tale, right? So structurally, things have to change. And this is a very interesting, very enigmatic way of calling attention to the structure. That isn't, it's not practical, it's not, it doesn't have that sort of liberal, you know, if you build it, they will come. You know, if we can make a better world, Nike, just do it. You know, these slogans are really easy to cycle back through the capital streams that we're engaging. So what we have to do, I think, is engage different kinds of logics and grammars to see our way through. The text that would be important here is The Undercommons by Fred Moten and Stefano Hani. And there's one moment in the interview piece in there where Fred Moten says, you know, people are always like, oh, well, what comes next? And he's like, I'm not here to tell you what comes next. I'm not a utopian in that way. You can't know what comes next because everything that's now is in your way. You have to tear it down in order to see what things could look like otherwise. And it's more along those lines that I think this unbuilding gets its traction from. Yeah, thank you for clarifying. There's one more.
There's one more question. Okay. Kathleen?
Yeah, thank you very much. I want to take up just this, what you said at the end, and I understand it that it is about the political dimension of what you associate. And I would like to know if you could explain a bit, maybe, or make me understand how or where do you see the the collective part of this practice you describe? Because you referred now on art, and art can also be very solipsistic. It can be an individual practice. And I think the examples make that clear, what could be the impact. But I also would wanted to know if you see there, let's say, a democratic or a collective element. So is there a possibility to make it a collective action, or does it remain something, and maybe that takes up the intentionality, something that has to be created by one person's clear idea, and this person then can also perform it alone?
Yeah, no. I mean, the work that I'm showing, it's gestural. It's gestural. It's to try to change the way we think. But there are collective implications. I really think there are. I mean, I was trying at the beginning when I'm talking about the way that the house shapes how we think about living with others, and it imposes very often a family form upon whoever is in that house, even though not everyone lives in a family setup, right? So we could think very, very easily, and you know, there are lots of places where people do this, about how living arrangements and different forms of architecture could change the way we think of community. So there's a really cool anthropologist, Martin Manalansan, who does ethnographies of Filipino gay men immigrants in New York City. And many of them live in group houses together. And the city considers this to be noxious and a health hazard, that sometimes 15 people are living in two-bedroom apartments. So he goes to do the ethnography, he goes to visit one of these apartments, and the people who are living there are like, oh, you think we're messy, you think this is a terrible way to live, but we are 15 people, we know each other's schedules, we live together in a kind of rhythm, we're in a rhythm so that people are home at different times. We share cooking. We share responsibilities. And in fact, this is a very reasonable way to live. At the same time, you've got people like when I was in California, there were these things that we called McMansions. They're massive houses with zero architectural value that maybe two people live in them. You know, that's the health hazard, is the massive house with two people in it, not the small apartment with 15 people who have figured out how to live together and share resources. In a moment of environmental decline, there's only the collectivity. There's only that moving forward that will change the way in which we use resources and so on. So that's why I said we don't have a homeless problem. We have a homeful problem. And we have no chance of actually rectifying that because, you know, capital is only in one place at this point. And so we have to think differently about how we would be in space together within very, very different kinds of arrangements. And this material, to me, it inspires me to think in different ways about sharing space. Let's put it that way. Yeah.
So thank you so much, Jack, for this wonderful, insightful, and revolutionary, or anarchistic, more like, talk. Thank you for the audience and the questions. I would like to just mention that this wonderful buffet, the wonderful reception now that you're all welcome to partake, is thanks to the Interuniversitäre Doktoratsprogramm Gender Studies. And we hope to see many of you next time when the Art of Intervention will be hosting here on November 13, if I'm not mistaken. It's on the program that you're probably sitting on or that you put in your bag. So thank you very much, and enjoy the buffet.